Well done on making it through reading week, and I hope you're all feeling flu free and all that. Right, this is a lecture, LMW lecture on Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by Joyce, and I'm going to try and do three things in the lecture. I hope I have time for the three things. Firstly, I'm going to compare some of the aspects of Joyce's style in a portrait with Somerset Maugham's style in Of Human Bondage. Hopefully in order to illustrate some of the characteristics of Joyce's writing. Secondly, I'm going to look at some of the ways in which James Joyce's book engages with the modern world. And then thirdly, I'm going to address the question of the authority of the author in a portrait, and in particular the relation of its main character, Stephen, to the author, Joyce. But before I start these things, I'm going to, a little bit of biographical background. James Joyce was born in 1882, died in 1941, and during his lifetime he published only three novels, one book of short stories, one play, and two collections of poetry. So in spite of this relatively small corpus of work, he's probably the most important modernist writer that you study on the course. His 1914 book of short stories was called Dubliners, was liked by Ezra Pound, who, as we've seen, kind of gets his fingers into every pie. He's a bit of an impresario of the modernist kind of period. And so Pound immediately arranged for Joyce's next novel, his first novel, Portrait of the Artist, to be published in installments in his in Pound's magazine, The Egoist. So it's published in installments in 1914 and 1915. And Joyce is obviously an Irish writer, but he left Ireland, it's important to say, in 1904, living in Paris, Zurich, Trieste, for the rest of his life. It's a portrait, although it's an Irish book, it's perhaps important that it's written on the shores of the Mediterranean. So, first part of my lecture, looking at the narrative style in Somerset Maugham and in Joyce. So let's look at the opening paragraphs in A Portrait, which is extract one on your handout. Famous opening lines. Once upon a time and a very good time, it was there that... Well, I'll start again. Once upon a time and a very good time it was, there was a moo cow coming down along the road, and this moo cow that was coming down along the road met a nice-sized little boy named Baby Taku. His father told him that story. His father looked at him through a glass. He had a hairy face. He was Baby Taku. The moo cow came down along the road where Betty Byrne lived. She sold lemon plat. Now, one of the reasons we put Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage onto the course last week, one of the reasons, was to provide you with an example of more traditional prose so that you would get an idea about the radicalism of the modernist writers, prose writers. So I'm going to make a little brief comparison of the opening of Human Bondage with the opening of Portrait. So if you look at extract two, the opening of Human Bondage, the day broke grey and dull, the clouds hung heavily, and there was a rawness in the air that suggested snow. A woman servant came into a room in which a child was sleeping and drew the curtains. She glanced mechanically at the house opposite, a stucco house with a portico, and went to the child's bed. "Wake up, Philip," she said. She pulled down the bedclothes, took him in her arms, and carried him downstairs. He was only half awake. "Your mother wants you," she said. She opened the door of a room on the floor below and took the child over to a bed in which a woman was lying. It was his mother. She stretched out her arms and the child nestled by her side. So what are the points of comparison here? Both texts are the opening lines of a Künstlerroman, a novel about the development of the artist, as Jeremy said last week, subgenre of the Bildungsroman. Both introduce the main protagonist in childhood, although Philip is older than Stephen at this point. But otherwise, the two openings seem fairly different. In the Maugham, the narrative displays many of the characteristics typical of a Victorian novel, I think. The author seems present in the text, directing our sympathies towards Philip, and doing so by the way that external events, in this case the death of Philip's mother, are narrated. There's an emphasis on external character description, characters with coherent, stable egos, a sort of empirical knowable setting in which the characters live and in which the action is set. There's a kind of known, steady portioning out of time within a novel structure. Whereas in the opening of Portrait, by contrast, the narrative style is more self-conscious immediately. It draws attention to itself as a construction, as a story in the opening phrase, once upon a time. You get the idea that it's a story. There's a story to be told. And it thereby raises the question of the relation between the story that the young baby hears, well, that we hear, the story we tell ourselves, and the reality of the world that we inhabit. So there's no easy, readily available setting in which we live, which can be separated from the language that we use to make sense of our position in the world. And in this way, characterization, place, and even time are complicated in those opening lines. And no such questions, I think, are raised by Morm. In A Portrait, there is no omniscient narrator. In an earlier version of the novel, written in 1904, called Stephen Hero, this is much longer, it does have an omniscient narrator. But as Joyce rewrote the book for Pound in 1914, he made Stephen the narrator and cut out all the sections in which Stephen wasn't present. So in this new version, Joyce is also absent from the text. The book famously contains the image of the artist sitting back, paring his fingernails to observe while he observes his creation, and this sort of image of the absent author, which we can question a bit later on. So external character description, which is kind of there in the Victorian novel, is replaced with this kind of relentless internal gaze in Joyce's work. Stephen doesn't have a sort of traditional, stable ego in the way that many of the predecessors might have done. And there's no attempt to describe the scenes and the settings in which the novel's action unfolds in a traditional kind of way. Time is also sort of fairly unevenly spread. You've got sometimes years of Stephen's life seem to pass, hardly mentioned or even unmentioned in the narrative, and then you get this focus on a few moments that sometimes goes on for pages. In Morm, the emphasis of the narrative, even in that opening section, is on the plot, which drives our understanding of the characters and our sympathies towards them as well. In Joyce, the narrative emphasis is on the protagonist's perception. That's quite a key word, I guess, for the novel, perception, and the way it's shaped by, or the way it resists, the stories and narratives that it receives. I think you can see similar trends in the way that the novels depict characters other than their main protagonists. For example, if you look towards the end of The Portrait, there's a section in which Stephen describes his feelings towards the girl that he bumps into as she leaves the Jacobs biscuit factories. This is extract 3 on your handout. An event which leads to a discussion of his own attitude towards women. It's all very kind of coloured through the prism of religion at this point. So she cried to him over her shoulder. "Do you like what you've seen of me? Straight hair and curly eyebrows." And yet he felt that, however he might revile and mock her image, his anger was also a form of homage. He had left the classroom in disdain that was not wholly sincere, feeling that perhaps the secret of her race lay behind those dark eyes upon which her long lashes flung a quick shadow. He had told himself bitterly as he walked through the streets that she was a figure of the womanhood of her country, a bat-like soul waking to the consciousness of itself in darkness and secrecy and loneliness, tarrying a while, loveless and sinless, with her mild lover, and leaving him to whisper of innocent transgressions in the latticed ear of a priest. His anger against her found vent in coarse railing at her paramour, whose name and voice and features offended his baffled pride. A priested peasant with a brother, a policeman in Dublin, and a brother, a potboy in Moycullen. To him she would unveil her soul's shy nakedness, to one who was but schooled in the discharging of a formal rite, rather than to him, a priest of eternal imagination, transmuting the daily bread of experience into the radiant body of eternal life. It's kind of, I think in this section, Stephen is giving voice to some kind of pretty unpleasant attitudes, in a way, towards the girl. She is seen as an image of the womanhood of her country, barely aware of her own consciousness, and content to unveil her soul's shy nakedness to men whom Stephen implies, and it's probably a bit of class snobbery, men that don't deserve her. While Stephen, who does, of course, deserve her, describing himself as a priest of the eternal imagination, goes bereft. But perhaps what stops this from being a classist, misogynist piece of writing is the narrative style. The free and direct discourse which relays to us readers what's going on in Stephen's head is self-consciously presenting these thoughts as Stephen's own, and also drawing our attention to Stephen's awareness of the fallibility of his own ideas. So he's kind of vaguely aware there's that phrase, baffled pride, and that his disdain is not wholly sincere. So in this way, Joyce's narrative style gives readers a bit of space to question the speaker, to question Stephen. And what's more, the narrative voice never crosses over into the head of the girl and tries to articulate her thoughts in a way that might support or counter Stephen's own interpretation. So no judgment is passed on her. She remains kind of like an other, I suppose. And we're aware that as readers that what is being explored is not her as a character, but Stephen's perception. I think this contrasts a bit with Morm's treatment of female characters in his novel. So if you look at extract 4, this is much later in the novel, and it's one of my students identified it last week as an example when Morm uses the narrative device of free and direct discourse to explain the thoughts of Mildred. So he's kind of getting inside her head. One or two things surprised her. She had been used to his subservience. He was only too glad to do anything for her in the old days. She was accustomed to see him cut down by a cross word and in ecstasy at a kind one. He was different now, and she said to herself that he had not improved in the last year. It never struck her for a moment that there could be any change in his feelings. Then came the conversation in which he told her that he intended their relations to be platonic, and remembering an incident of their common past, it occurred to her that he dreaded the possibility of her becoming pregnant. She took pains to reassure him. It made no difference. She was the sort of woman who was unable to realize that a man might not have her own obsession with sex. Her relations with men had been purely on those lines, and she could not understand that they ever had other interests. So again, on the face of it, the extracts seem quite similar. Like the Joyce extract, the Morm extract seems to be fairly pejorative in its view of women and the female character in question. And unlike the Joyce extract, Morm's narrator actually crosses over into Mildred's head and seems to present things from her point of view. And in that way, Morm seems to be giving her a kind of life of her own in the text. Yet there are also, I think, major differences. As is often the case with Morm's writing in this novel, he only enters Mildred's head really to confirm for readers the impression that readers have of her from Philip. And this is consistent, as I say, with what he does all the way through, really. The narrator enters the head of another character only in order to direct readers' sympathy or antipathy towards Philip. So you can see the same thing, for example, earlier on in the book, in the bullying scene in the dormitory of the boarding school, when the narrative briefly enters the teacher's head in order to show how sorry they feel for Philip, but how they can do nothing to help him, leaving him instead to the sort of mercy of the bullies. One of my students 2 weeks ago pointed out that she didn't mind the way that the opening sections of the Morm novel directed readers' sympathies towards this kind of main character, Philip, because she thought as she was reading that this was a really clever narrative device to show the egocentrism of Philip in his childhood. But then as the novel unfolded, she realized that his narrative style, which does direct our sympathies, is actually just continues all the way through his adulthood as well. So it's an unchanging feature of the book. And in this section I've just read, for example, you can see the author intruding at one point to direct our sympathies against Mildred even more forcefully. In that last line of the extract, she was the sort of woman who was unable to realize that a man might not have her own obsession with sex. Her relations with men had been purely on those lines, and she could not understand that they'd ever had other interests. And this is either the author intruding, or it's Mildred repeating Philip's accusations about her. Either way, the Morn reader, as one of my students again said last week, is left feeling manipulated and stifled and a bit claustrophobic, because she's never allowed to reach her own conclusions about the characters described. So one of the things that you could do in your, one of the activities you could do in your seminars would be to compare the kind of narrative styles of the two authors in the above extracts or others. And you could discuss the way that the narrative style develops as the portrait of the artist unfolds, and how this narrative style changes to reflect the changing consciousness of its narrator, of Stephen. You might also consider whether I'm being a bit too harsh on Mum, and whether his narrative style, in contrast to what I've just argued, actually presents characters in a way that's up for scrutiny, in the way that is similar to Joyce's. So don't take my word for it, I suppose. And I suppose a related issue raised by that last extract is Joyce's treatment of women in the text. Stephen, it seems, either has to idealize women or treat them as prostitutes. And the female characters of a portrait, insofar as they are characters, are predominantly either innocent and beautiful, or they are or whores. And at one point, one possible escape from this dichotomy comes from the Catholic Church. Stephen sort of venerates the Virgin Mary. But to worship her is to set her up as some kind of impossible figure, sort of the mother who's never had sex. And real women, of course, can never live up to that ideal. So even when he loses his veneration for Mary, Stephen goes back to his earlier characterization of women. For example, towards the novel's end, in his comparison of the woman in the waves to a seabird, doesn't he regress to an idealized depiction of women's beauty, of woman as beauty? So another question you might like to discuss in your seminars is the relation of Joyce to what is arguably Stephen's misogyny. Is Joyce, like, ironically distant from it? Does his kind of self-conscious narrative style mean that his portrayal of women is held up for scrutiny within the text? Perhaps you could argue that this Stephen's view of women is a result of his religious upbringing, and that is made clear within the text as well. Or does the, more troublingly, does the text suggest that Stephen's view of women are the same as Joyce's? So there's all these possibilities, and I think that coming to an understanding of the way that Joyce treats women in this text is kind of key to your interpretation of it, really. It's definitely something that you should think about. Okay, the second part of my lecture, how the portrait engages with the modern world. And I think I want to argue that one of the ways it engages with the modern world is by complicating our understanding of who we are in the modern world. So it doesn't really present any easy answers. It makes it more difficult, but that is a good thing. Often that's what good literature does. And in particular, it complicates our understanding of the relation between the self and the world. It's an investigation, maybe, into the way that the self is constructed by kind of larger forces in society and the extent to which the self can escape from those larger forces, escape the kind of destiny that the narrative has in store for it. And the narratives that the text particularly questions are nationality, religion, and language. And again, if we just look back to the opening lines, we can sort of illustrate this point again. So if you look at those opening lines of A Portrait, Once Upon a Time, etc., etc., think, what are its striking features? And maybe the first thing that hits you is that the narrator tells the story from the perspective of a young boy called Baby Tuku, the character that grows up to become Stephen. So in that opening paragraph, if we look at it closely, the boy is either repeating a story that his father has told him, one that he's learned by heart, or it's the father telling Stephen the story. Either way, it's through the stories and names that the baby hears that the mind records its first impressions of the world. So first comes the story, and then in the third paragraph, with the line, he was Baby Tuku, the narrator identifies himself with a character that he's heard from the story. And with the next line, the moo cow came down the road where Betty Byrne lived, the boy is beginning to make sense of the world around him through the stories he's heard. So you've got this flow of sensory impressions from a young child that seems to take us straight into the mind of the small boy narrator. And the way it's written also draws attention to the way in which that narrator's perception of reality is shaped by the stories that he hears. And in that sense, the language speaks Stephen. And this is kind of an ongoing thing which runs through the whole novel. But it's not as simple as that. Because there's already a sense that the world cannot be reduced to a story, that the world is introducing things to the little boy that the story his father tells him hasn't accounted for. So Betty Byrne, for example, is not in the story that his father tells him, and nor is the fact that she sells lemon plat. And the child is already making his own observations about his father. He looked at him through glass. So in other words, the world is always throwing things at him which are not accounted for by the stories that he receives and that he's got to come to terms with. So what I'm trying to argue is that these opening paragraphs set up key issues that the novel goes on to explore. How can Stephen speak his own words? Or is he going to remain spoken for by the different narratives that try to speak for him? How can the artist escape from the received inherited stories that make sense of his life for him? And how can he reconcile the world he lives in with the stories he receives about how he should make sense of it? And as Stephen grows up, you can see how these questions are rephrased in different contexts. And most famously, near the end of the novel, Stephen declares, "When the soul of man is born in this country, there are nets flung at it to hold it back from flight. You talk to me of nationality, language, religion. I shall try to fly by those nets." It's extract 5 on your handout. And this way, in a way, this is a declaration of intent. And it's a rephrasing of the issues that are raised on the opening page. How can the prospective artist free himself from the stories that are already written for him, in which he is taught from birth to place himself, and through which he makes sense of the world around him? And obviously there's a world of difference between the small child making sense of his world through the stories his dad tells him, and the young adult trying to resist the most kind of powerful narratives of his time. But the principle is the same. So an activity that you might like to carry out in your seminars is to read those opening paragraphs, read the extract on page 177, extract 5, and consider whether and how those issues are explored through the text. Whether and how the issues that are raised in the opening lines are explored later in the novel. And if you look at that extract 5 a bit more closely, there's a sort of romanticism in Stephen at this point, something of Rousseau's, man is born free but is everywhere in chains. But because of the narrative style, we are free to question whether this is a view that is shared by Joyce. Nonetheless, it does seem that Stephen here suggests the natural state for the soul is to fly free, but the nationality, language, and religion are nets which somehow catch it and stop it from flying. So a good question to consider is, how does each of these things, nationality, language, and religion, prevent Stephen's soul from taking flight? And how does he deal with that? So if you look at religion briefly, in chapter 3, after hearing all those sermons about sin and the state of the soul and the need to confess his sins, Stephen eventually sees himself in the same terms as those he's heard from the sermon. So if you look briefly at extract 6, this is Stephen talking. That was the work of devils, to scatter his thoughts and overcloud his conscience, assailing him at the gates of the cowardly and sin-corrupted flesh, and praying God timidly to forgive him for his weakness. He covered his face again with his hands. He had sinned. He had sinned so deeply against heaven and before God that he was not worthy to be called God's child. And this tortured and grotesque self-description occurs after Father Arnold's Hell and Damnation sermon. So is this a demonstration of the net of religion stopping his soul from taking flight? And it certainly illustrates how religious discourse delivered from the kind of pulpit with all the authority that a church father carries with him gains power over Stephen. But it's also significant that it only gains a power when Stephen starts believing in it and recreating himself through that received religious language. But it's very hard to break free of. It seems to shape, infect his perceptions about Ireland, about women, about the spiritual, material world. Even his aesthetic theory is shaped by this religious discourse. And finding a way through is no simple matter. And he doesn't achieve a breakthrough by something that he does, by some kind of plot-driven action. In a way, doing something directly opposed to what the religious discourse expects, like visiting a prostitute, sort of reinforces the worldview put forward by the religion and makes them even more susceptible to being reconverted later. So in the end, how does he fly by those nets, or does he? And perhaps he does eventually succeed, but it's a more kind of hard-won form of flying by the net of religion, and it's based on the development of his view of aesthetics and perception. So he eventually develops a view of art which is taken from religion, but which he develops into a secular vision. He recreates this kind of religious inheritance in terms that are fit for the modern world and fit for an artist who is fashioning his own world. And an example is when Stephen is trying to express to his friends what it means to respond to art. He argues that the capacity to attend aesthetically to anything, even ordinary objects, is what is important. So he takes from Aquinas, his account of beauty, the idea of wholeness leading to harmony, leading to radiance. But then in chapter 5, extract 7, on your handout, when Stephen sees the butcher's basket, it's clear that his vision of beauty differs from that of Aquinas in a quite essential way. So when you have apprehended that basket as one thing and have then analysed it according to its form and apprehended it as a thing, you make the only synthesis which is logically and aesthetically permissible. You see that it is the thing which it is and no other thing. The radiance of which he, Aquinas, speaks is the quiditas, the whatness of a thing. This supreme quality is felt by the artist when the aesthetic image is first conceived in his imagination. So Stephen suddenly sees the basket as distinct from everything else. In other words, he sees its wholeness. Then he sees its kind of internal shape, i.e. its harmony. And then he uses the word itself. He experiences its radiance. But whereas with Aquinas, that radiance and that illumination comes from outside of him, comes from God, for Stephen, the radiance comes from the illumination of the human mind, attending on its own presence in the material world. So in other words, that radiance comes from Stephen, from the perceiver, And this is a big difference from the kind of vision that he's inherited. And this, I suppose, is modernity. We live in a world that we create. And the world is always coming at us, full of meaning, and we have no choice but to interpret it. The world is not there to be interpreted as some kind of code through which truths can be divined about the nature of another world. There is no other world than this one that we constantly interpret and create. That seems to be one of the things that's implied by Joyce's vision here. Okay, coming back to flying by those nets and thinking about language and nationality, the other major authority which kind of tries to author Stephen here is the English language. And he realizes when speaking to the dean of the college that the very language with which he names things is, of course, not his own. He speaks English, which is the language, of the people that have colonized his country. This is extract 8. That, said Stephen, is that called a funnel? Is it not a tundish? What is a tundish? That, the funnel. Is that called a tundish in Ireland? Asked the dean. I never heard the word in my life. It's called a tundish in Lower Drumcondra, said Stephen, laughing, where they speak the best English. A tundish, said the dean reflectively. That is a most interesting word. I must look that word up. Upon my word, I must. And the little word seemed to have turned a rapier point of his sensitiveness against this courteous and vigilant foe. He felt with a smart of dejection that the man to whom he was speaking was a countryman of Ben Jonson. He thought, the language in which we are speaking is his before it is mine. I cannot speak or write these words without unrest of spirit. His language, so familiar and so foreign, will always be for me an acquired speech. I have not made or accepted its words. My voice holds them at bay. My soul frets in the shadow of his language. And this dialogue is a statement, too, of the difficulty of flying by the net of language, because the writer, of course, cannot free himself from language. And in a portrait, one of the things that Joyce does is develop a new style which shows how the mind's impression of reality is constituted by language in the first place. So as inhabitants of the modern world, we do not genuinely, originally experience reality, but we have that reality created for us by language. So in that sense, we are spoken by language. But a portrait can be read as Joyce's investigation of the possibility that we can master the way language speaks us and recreate that reality around us. So perhaps one of the possibilities that the text raises is that once we are self-conscious that language speaks us, creating our reality, it no longer quite does so in the same way. So the world that we see, in other words, is contingent upon the language with which we see it. And while this alienates us from any notion that we experience unmediated reality, it also makes us highly conscious of the way that reality is mediated to us. So this self-consciousness is a characteristic of modernity, of all our lives. So by turns, it's a curse which alienates us from any direct experience, but also containing with it the possibility of flying by the net of language. In our alienation from the world lies the possibility that we are not unconsciously written by it. Portrait also, it has to be said, focuses on a very particular aspect of this, when the language you speak has been imposed on you by a colonial power. The artist cannot free himself from the first language he learns to speak, and when that language has been colonially imposed, the writer is put at odds with his first language, often. So in this instance, by drawing attention to how English is his before it is mine, Stephen is opening up the question of who owns the English language. And by asking the question, he changes the situation. He opens the possibility that Joyce would pursue in later works, subtly reappropriating the English language for the Irish. And this is a major concern of literature for the rest of the 20th century in countries that threw off imperialist rule. And in his later works, in particular in Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, Joyce dislocates English, the language of colonization, not only by incorporating into it elements of other European languages, but also by subverting the norms of English propriety. So lots of kind of scatological jokes, lots of kind of Irish vernacular comes into and reclaims the English language, I suppose. So, in other words, he regards the English language, he came to regard the English language, not as a kind of sign of domination over Ireland, but as the rightful property of his people. And I think in this sense, he anticipates other writers from other ex-colonies in the British Empire. For example, Salman Rushdie, who argues that the English language ceased to be the sole possession of the English some time ago. And you can see this anticipated in Joyce in A Portrait. So, even if Joyce's aim is to reappropriate the English language for Ireland, this is not achieved until later novels. Something nonetheless is achieved by Stephen at the end of this novel, A Portrait. It's sort of a novel in which, by indirection, he finds direction out. And his conclusion about flying by those nets of language, nationality, and religion is a starting point for subsequent Joyce work. And it's carefully phrased. It's not a breaking free from those nets. It's more a matter of the artist recognizing the construction of those nets, precisely how they might snare him, and then setting out on a path which tries to avoid becoming enmeshed. And in that sense, it's a Bildungsroman with a difference. It's not only about the development and formation of the young artist, but also about the taking apart or the dismantling of ideologies which structure society. So by recognizing the construction of those nets, Stephen is pioneering a way to kind of dismantling the formations and structures which would shape and would write him. So he's opening up the tantalizing possibility that one day these kind of ideologies lose their authority, or lose their power. So another question for your seminars, is the portrait about construction, as a kind of Bildungsroman normally is, identity, artist, new language, new nationality, or is it about a dismantling of old ideas about the self, of language, old ideas about the artist? I suppose it comes down to the question of, does Stephen fly by those nets, and if so, how? Finally, briefly, I want to turn to the third area of my lecture, the question of the authority of the author in A Portrait. And it's a novel which investigates whether artists must suffer the predicament of being spoken for by a language, or whether it's one of the characteristics of the age that the modern artist can break free from those traditions, an author himself. And this raises the question of the authority of the author in the modern age. And I suppose, like Eliot and like Carlos Williams, Joyce is interested in this issue. And whereas Eliot invokes previous authors from the European tradition and yet kind of questions their authority in the modern world, and Carlos Williams questions the authority of the author by taking lines straight from advertising, for example, A Portrait can be read as an investigation into that same question: what is the authority of the author? So I want to sort of explore that a little bit. And Joyce had a high view of the importance of the writer to the community. He believed that the writer was important to the conscience of a community. And this is obviously not without precedent. For example, the romantic poet Shelley talked about how poets were the unacknowledged legislators of the nation. But if we think about the title of the text at this point, I think it gives us a bit of an insight into Joyce's thinking on this. A portrait of the artist as a young man. What is a portrait? And it's a form of art that's made out of people painted, obviously, but it's often the painter or the artist who's more important. Is the artist of the novel's title Joyce, or is it the artist in some kind of archetypal sense? And the final part of the title, as a young man, implies that the writer is perhaps implies that the writer is more mature than the artist depicted in the novel. So there's a sense of progression in the novel. The idea that Stephen is working towards a kind of view of art that he can't quite bring off. And by giving him the name Daedalus, from the Greek for skillful, Joyce seems to be drawing our attention to paternal relations, father-son relations. So in Greek myth, Daedalus obviously built the Minotaur's maze and then escaped from Crete by making a flying machine out of feathers and wax. And so you might think that by calling him Daedalus, Joyce is suggesting that the possibility of artistic triumph, escaping through art from political tyranny, perhaps. But in the myth, the son fails to escape. So perhaps that possibility of escape is closed off. It's something to discuss in your seminars. But where is Joyce in this? Is he the son Icarus, or is he the father Daedalus? In each chapter, there are elements in Stephen of Icarus, the son who flies too near the sun and then plunges back to earth. And the kind of novel seems to follow that pattern, whereby Stephen has a triumph at the end of a chapter, but then is brought down to earth again, back to ground at the beginning of the next. Stephen says in chapter 5, "There is no such thing as free thinking, inasmuch as all thinking is bound by its own laws." And at the end of the chapter, when he comes plunging back down to earth, or the beginning of the chapter, when he comes plunging back down to earth, he's in a sense reaching the limit of the new way of thinking he's been immersed in during the previous chapter. So this might suggest that Joyce himself is putting his creation, Stephen, through experiences from which he is expected to learn. So Joyce is like a father figure who knows more than his kind of creation, Stephen. Or, there's another possibility, you could say that by writing the narrative of the artist, Joyce is opening up artistic ground on which he would create his future works. So, in a weird way, does Joyce make Stephen the father of the artist to be Joyce? Is Stephen the father of Joyce's later artistic selves? Is Joyce's own begetter? By writing Portrait, is Joyce engaging in an act of self-creation? So Joyce, the writer who renounces Catholicism, leaves Ireland to live in continental Europe, is he refusing to be authored by the traditions that would define him, and in a sense becoming the archetypal modern artist, the author of himself? And if so, in what sense does Stephen break free from Joyce, the author who would control him? Does he always remain written by Joyce? I mean, he wrote the book. Joyce wrote the book. Or is there a sense in which Stephen passes by that particular net too, becoming in some ways independent of his author? So perhaps you could read the move away from free indirect discourse to the first person diary in the final section as a symbol of Stephen's independence from Joyce. Perhaps too, in the image of the artist sitting back paring his fingernails, there is an independence for the character that he has created. Final thought. In Stephen's final statement of intent, his desire to forge in the smithy of his soul the uncreated conscience of his race, is he making a statement about Ireland? Or is he making a wider claim about some kind of new race? Modern man, modern woman. That word race might be quite important. All these questions are well worth discussing in your seminars, but they come down to that kind of key question again of what's the relation between Joyce and Stephen? It's a major thing to think about. What's the relation between Joyce and Stephen in this text? Okay, finally, I know it's been a bit intense, this lecture, but sorry, it's a hard text. I've put the names of some Joycean critics on your handout. And I think I said before that there are obviously a lot of you and a lot of demand for the text, so please use the Cambridge Companion to series, which is available online through the library. There's also lots of e-journals that you can use, and there are some instructions, if you're not already clear about how to do it and using them confidently already, how you get access to the e-journals through the library website. Okay, thank you very much.